From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. The day of this recording is July 8th, 2019. Today I'm going to talk about three articles that I picked from this past week or so. One of them looks at the risk of stroke and other outcomes in patients who've had perioperative atrial fibrillation after non-cardiac surgery. Another looks at myocardial infarction with non-obstructive coronary disease and future risk. And the last one is an update on TAVR in valve-in-valve replacement for degenerated stentless bioprosthetic aortic valves. The first is an article from the European Heart Journal looking at the risk of stroke and other cardiovascular outcomes in patients with perioperative atrial fibrillation out at 1 year after non-cardiac surgery. And this is a database from the POISE 1 and 2 trials, where you recall that various medications were provided in a randomized fashion to patients having non-cardiac surgery. This pooled analysis asked the question whether perioperative atrial fibrillation was associated with stroke at 1 year. They excluded patients who'd had prior atrial fibrillation, and they looked at patients who had atrial fibrillation within 30 days of surgery that was clinically symptomatic and required treatment, and did multivariable analysis to try to adjust for various confounders to come up with a hazard ratio of the risk of stroke. Overall, there were about 18,000 patients in the study. Just a little over 2% developed postoperative AFib. And not surprisingly, those individuals were older, more likely to have diabetes, congestive heart failure, a prior stroke, or a TIA. The incidence of stroke was about 5.6 per 100 patient years in patients with the AFib versus 1.5 in patients who didn't have it. There was an increased risk of stroke in patients with perioperative AFib, and the hazard ratio was 4.17 that persisted to be above 3 after adjustment for covariates. And there was also a higher risk of mortality, vascular mortality, and myocardial infarction. So the authors concluded that patients who have perioperative atrial fibrillation after non-cardiac surgery within 30 days do appear to have a higher risk of stroke and other cardiovascular outcomes at 1 year. Of course, we don't know the mechanism for stroke. And a couple of other limitations that are interesting in this particular database. You remember that in POISE 1, patients were randomized to high doses of beta blockers. And the beta blockers were associated with a higher risk of stroke because of presumably hypotension. And in POISE 2, there were patients randomized to aspirin or not. So there are some limitations for sure, both of the analysis and some of the confounding things that are unique to these two trials. Nevertheless, I think this does illustrate the fact that when we find atrial fibrillation after non-cardiac surgery, we should be asking ourselves, does the patient have a high CHA2DS2-VASc score? Are there other risk factors that would suggest that at the appropriate interval, anticoagulation should be entertained? Obviously, this would be much better if we had a trial looking specifically at that question. Until then, we have observational data like this. Let's go on to the second article. I've always been fascinated by myocardial infarction that occurs in patients with non-obstructive coronary arteries. And this is a really nice publication, also from the European Heart Journal, looking at MINOCA among patients 65 and older. The data was actually taken from the National Cardiovascular Disease Registry CATH PCI database from 2009 to 2013, and then linked to claims data for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. This particular study looked at the outcomes of people who had MINOCA versus patients with MI and at least a 50% or more greater stenosis in an epicardial vessel. And again, this is a primary endpoint looking at adverse events at 12 months. So big study, over 280,000 admissions for MI, 275,000 unique patients, and about 19,000 or 5.9% had MINOCA. So overall, in elderly patients, the incidence of MINOCA is around 6%. The 12-month outcomes for MINOCA were less severe than for patients with epicardial disease, combined endpoint, 18.7% versus 27%. The mortality was similar, 12% for Minocca versus about 17% for patients with CAD. And rehospitalization, heart failure were lower in Minocca patients. Stroke was similar at around 1.5%. Overall, Minocca patients had about a 43% lower adjusted risk for a MACE event over 12 months. So the study had a couple of important conclusions. First of all, patients over the age of 65 with Minocca represent about 6% of all MI in that cohort. And they still have higher risk. One in five has an event over the next 12 months. What are the consequences of that? Well, 5% of patients with Minocca die within 30 days of a diagnosis. Almost 40% are rehospitalized within 1 year. The mechanisms for Minocca are really hard to understand. We think that microvascular dysfunction, coronary plaque disruption that clears at cath, epicardiovasospasm, thrombosis, embolism, they all may be involved, and one patient may have one or more of these mechanisms. Clearly, having an MI, even if you have fairly clean coronaries, is not a good thing at any age and certainly over the age of 65. An interesting take-home point from this was that the presence of dual antiplatelet therapy in Minocca patients did not appear to relate to outcomes. Admittedly, this is an observational study, but it certainly does highlight the need for us to have better understanding of the proper pharmacological approach to patients who have a Minocca event. So, food for thought. Let's move on then to the third article that I wanted to talk about today, which was a very nice study reported in the JACC Intervention on TAVR with aortic valve in valve replacement for degenerated stentless bioprosthetic aortic valves. And this is a study from three hospitals who collected data between 2013 and 2019. They found 66 patients who underwent a valve in valve TAVR for a failed or degenerated stentless bioprosthetic aortic valve, and looked at perioperative outcomes and then longer-term complications. There were 66 patients in total. The mortality was 3% at 30 days and about 10% at 1 year. As you might expect, after TAVR, the left ventricular end diastolic dimension improved. Coronary occlusion is a concern in these patients, and it occurred in about 10% of patients who had the valve-in-valve TAVR, but an MI was only documented in 3%. Predictors of coronary occlusion included subcoronary implant technique compared to a full root replacement, a short simulated radial valve to coronary distance, and low coronary height. Coronary arteries that originated just at or below a centimeter above the valve were present in about a third of these patients. So the authors concluded that TAVR in stentless bioprosthetic valves that fail is safe, and there's a good short-term risk and long-term risk. However, the coronary anatomy is a problem and something that we're going to continue to have to wrestle with as this field of interventional therapies for valve disease continues to evolve. So I appreciate your listening to the Eagle's Eye View this week. We've talked about perioperative stroke after non-cardiac surgery, myocardial infarction in non-obstructive coronary arteries, and then TAVR in degenerated valves today. I try to pick three articles that I think are relevant to practice every week to share with you on this podcast. Thanks for listening. Until next week, I hope you have a good one. Thank you.